I know my friends are over it. They've been rolling their eyes since. Boston, still too damn far away. That's Feature Teens. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. That was a little bit the tone of Ross Atkins' press conference yesterday, and a little bit of the tone I saw on Twitter after the Blue Jays absolutely pasted the New York Yankees 9-2. It is obviously good. It is preferable to getting beaten 9-2 instead, but still plenty of work ahead as the Jays remain 6.5 back of, I mean, I used Boston because that's the lyric, but Boston is not the team the Jays are most immediately trailing in the wild card race. Now that would be the Kansas City Royals in that final wild card spot. But yeah, good win for the Blue Jays. Interesting day of media availability for Ross Atkins, who spoke with the beat down outside the dugout around 3 o'clock yesterday, did Blair and Barker, did some other media, didn't want to do Jays Talk Plus. He didn't want to have analytics, didn't want to get analytics in circles, I guess. I don't know how that works out. I wasn't down there. It was also the NBA draft yesterday. Raptors busy with that. Raptors busy re-signing Emmanuel Quickley to a new contract. Canada Basketball's camp gets going today as well. So busy in the basketball world. Great to hear J.D. Bunkus have Raptors general manager Bobby Webster on the show just before we came on here. So a lot going on. And through all of that, kind of, I guess, sliding under the radar was the Jays. Obviously the Atkins stuff is front of mind for everyone. Those are the quotes going around, the reactions going around. And I certainly felt a certain way about the idea of having that press conference and then the content of it. And then all the NBA stuff is going on as well. The NHL draft is also today. So Jeff Merrick, who follows us after, is down in Vegas for that. Within all that, the Jays put up an 8th spot on Carlos Rodon in the first two innings, including George Springer having a 2-home-run, 6-RBI day. Let's break some of this down. We're joined now by Keegan Matheson, our pal from MLB.com, from BlueJays.com. And Keegan, the question that is front of everyone's mind is, did you give a little piece of that apple fritter to the dog who was begging so cutely for it on Twitter?
No. No, I didn't. If this is what cancels me, so be it. But it's what I had been looking forward to. And you know what? I pay more rent than this dog here, let me tell you. So I had to assert a little bit. I felt bad. She's very cute. But I did the whole thing. I feel bad about it right now. My guilt is building as we talk. But I took the whole thing myself. I might be a bad guy.
I can't remember. Oh, it was Bub Carrington. In the NBA draft got asked cats or dogs at the draft when he got selected, which is just like, I know, like that's a question the team like social media account does or whatever, but it's interesting to hear it asked on draft night. And he said he doesn't like dogs, like period. Now apparently he was attacked by a dog as a kid, but like he got full on booed at the draft for saying he didn't like dogs. You gotta be careful here, Keegan.
It's controversial. Like at heart, I am more of a cat man, just given my demeanor. I suppose I feel like we agree with one another. This small dog and I were not immediate best friends when my girlfriend and I met, but we've become buddies. Now you see me, I'm the big man, small dog walking down King West, looking real slick. But you know what? I think the dog had enough last night when I came home. She had some French fries while I had a bourbon, and you know, it's a beautiful diet.
As you downloaded a bourbon, as the parlance of the
downloaded,
days.
Baby. Oh, that word was ringing in my head as I was trying to sleep. I was lurching awake. The English language means less and less every single hour of every single day. But downloaded, baby, that was the word yesterday.
Yes, the English language meaning less from corporate speak like that we'll get into in a little bit. Also, if you were watching a certain something else after the Blue Jays game last night down in America, maybe your concept of the English language eroded as well. Just all sorts of weird. Let's start with the positive, though. Let's start with the actual game. Yeah. And George Springer hitting a 3-run home run in the first, a 3-run home run in the first, a 3-run home run in the second as well. He finishes with 3 homers, 6 RBI. Over the last two games, he's 6-for-8 with 3 home run, 8 RBI. He has increased his on-base plus slugging, his OPS, by 60 points over the last two games. Look, we've been talking about this a lot. None of us, I don't think, are going to be like, you know, George Springer is solved. He hit 2 Carlos Rodon fastballs at 97. He can get back around velocity. But it does feel very, very notable that not only did George Springer have a couple of good games, he did do it against Velocity. And I know you spoke to him after the game. You spoke to John Schneider as well. What was kind of the let's start with George Springer himself. What was his, you know, level of exhale or level of positivity coming out of that one?
There was some relief with George, but he continued to come back to the fact that he still needs to do more. He was bringing that up himself. I think I asked him about the relief of this and how he can continue that forward. And he said he hopes it spirals in a good way now instead of how it had been going. But even when the question was not about his early struggles, he kept bringing it back to that. So he's very aware of this. Players are 99% of the time aware of what's being said about them. They either read what is said or they lie about reading what is said. It's understandable. It's human nature. These guys are aware of where they stand on their team in baseball and what the general consensus is. And George is smart. He knows what's going to be said when your numbers are what they've been. So that was evidently on his mind. But I like what he's done lately. Credit to him for doing this, because it hasn't looked pretty a lot of the time. I mean, most of the time, it has looked just as bad as the numbers. But he has stuck with this. And I know the quotes about when a manager says these guys don't quit. I hate those quotes, too. I know nobody's walking off the field. But I have been around players who don't care. I've been around quite a few players who don't care, who pack it in, who say, I've got my deal. I'm just going to enjoy this, stroll in at 6 p.m. and play a ball game. Quit doesn't mean walk off the field necessarily. And I've seen a lot of this from George lately, being there early, the work he is putting in. So credit to him for doing this for a couple of games. Obviously, you want it for a couple of months, but it's finally some payoff to all of those times that John Schneider has said it's coming.
It is. And look, the secret data that they have, you know, we joke about it a little bit, but, you know, Ross Atkins was on Blair and Barker and he talked about it a little bit as well, talking about, you know, some of, and every fan hates to hear this, but, you know, the good misses. It reminds me of, if you've ever seen Space Jam, which I'm sure you have, right?
Oh yeah.
When Michael Jordan,
absolutely.
When Michael Jordan is playing in the minor leagues, and he strikes out, and all his teammates are like, oh, that strikeout looked real good, man. Like nobody looks as good as you striking out. And Michael Jordan's like getting frustrated that everyone's giving him a pass for poor performance. That's what it can sometimes sound like. It's a real thing that they have to look at. So, you know, what John Schneider's obviously not going to do a victory lap after two good games from George Springer, but he had been pretty adamant about sticking with him. You know, I wonder, would he even have been in the lineup every game earlier this week and last weekend had Dalton Varsho not, you know, tweaked his back and been out of the lineup a little bit. But what was Schneider's, I know George Springer, he did a good job keeping it grounded, keeping the focus on, I got to do more. From John Schneider's standpoint, did he reveal a little bit at all, you know, what they had been seeing that led him to be confident this was coming around, or was it more of a just like, George is George, we just trusted that he was going to be George again?
You could tell that John Schneider really loved it. Like, he was really pleased with it. Obviously he is, but I spend enough time around Schneider, far more than he would prefer, I'm sure. But I'm always there, and I can hear the tone of his voice, how he says things day after day, year after year. You could tell from the tone of his voice, how he was saying this, that he really loved it. This wasn't just another player hitting a couple of home runs. This was a guy finally doing it that he had supported. And to have that payoff has to be rewarding from a managerial standpoint, but also a player. And then he kind of did reference those quotes, Blake. Let me read you what he said here. There have been a lot of things that people don't get to see or hear every single day that we do that may have led me to say the things that I have the last couple of weeks. So that is a kind of a polite dunking, a polite I told you so. And you know what? He earned it. Absolutely. That's fair play. And for the context of those, Blake, I mean, 90% of the time that there's a quote out there from John Schneider saying, George just needs a couple of days, George is George, it's usually me asking about why George Springer has not been playing well. And so when I asked him about George Springer hitting a couple of home runs, that's fair play. I liked it, honestly. And if you're going to point to stuff that's going to turn around, well, it better. And a couple of days may have been a bit of a rocky timeline, but it did. And for a manager, that's got to feel good. because over and over again, John Schneider has had to back up his players and has had to say he thinks it's going to turn around. I know people don't like that. I don't always like that either, but I also realize, well, what the heck else are you going to say? Are you going to say, hey, this guy's toast? No. There's better ways around it sometimes, but to have that actually work out for John Schneider, who has stood behind George Springer for a long time. We're talking about last year as well when we had this whole conversation about the leadoff spot. This has been going for a while. There's some relief. And when he circled back to the things they've been able to see that we haven't, I kind of sat there in the press conference room and smiled. I said, okay, fair. That's fair.
Yeah, and it is. So it's you know, like you said, turnabout is fair play there. Now, if George Springer ends the year with an 800 OPS, that's going to look a lot different than if he, you know, if he just gets back to kind of a league average hitter from here. How long a runway do you like? Obviously, I made the comment that his OPS jumped like 60 points, so he's back above 600 on the OPS front. And as bizarre as it sounds, that like he's not all that far off from league at like he's like two hot weeks from being back to league average at the plate for the year. We'll deal with that when we get to it. But how much do you need to see? So for me. And I'm apologies for answering my own question first, but I look at like, okay, the three hit game the other day, you know, there was one good sinker that he made a good swing on, but one of the other hits was like a soft one that just kind of bled through. Even the home run, like maybe stays in some other parks, but hey, you still, even if it hadn't gone out, you hit a ball to the track. That's good. But yesterday was really encouraging to me because of how he got away. Carlos Rodon looked awful yesterday, but it's still 96, 97. For him to get around on. And this is a guy who at times this year has had a bit of a tough time with like 93, 94. So what are you looking for in the specifics of what Springer is doing? And you know, how obviously he's not going to come out and shouldn't say obviously, maybe he does hit two home runs again tonight. But you know, what kind of a time frame are you looking for here or a sample size, for lack of a better term, to think that, hey, this isn't just a blip, whether it's the swing change, whether it's the work he's been doing on velocity, something has happened here that George Springer's turned a corner.
I think these past couple of days buy him a few weeks. You know, if he goes 0-for-4 tonight, whatever. He's at least shown something here that makes you inhale and look at this through fresher eyes at this point. I want to see George Springer doing this against different types of pitchers. Now, you go back to the Boston series, Bayo throws hard. He has no idea where it's going. That was a mess of a game. But Rodon is a lefty. Now, if George Springer goes out and hits a home run against a slider from a righty or takes a pitch that's away instead of inside, when you're doing it against different types of pitchers, different types of pitches, that shows me, that the success is on the side of the hitter. Not that they're just getting a good pitch and doing something with it, but that they are adapting around these pitchers, because that's always the back and forth. And that's the kind of brain disease that baseball gives you. When a guy gets hot, you're thinking, okay, who's going to adjust to this and make this good story end? It's a very healthy way to live a life. But with Springer right now, other pitchers are suddenly going to look at him and say, okay, this is not the weak at bat where we can just bust him high with velocity. He might be catching up on this now. So that's going to be an adjustment game in the next few weeks. But bigger picture, Blake, I want to see him doing this against different types of pitchers, lefties, righties, velocity, breaking balls. And he's off to a fine start. And confidence can help, too. I think right now, instead of trying to find this, George can just try to sustain this. And when you are reaching and searching for that, you know, George knows what his contract is. He gets his own bank statement. Like, he knows the realities of this. And that pressure is probably a lot less today. He's probably going into the ballpark feeling way better than he has most home games this year.
I would love to go into the ballpark later feeling much better than I have most days this year.
I can't imagine.
That'd be wonderful. Okay, so some other good stuff happening as well. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is in a nice little power surge here. I believe he's hit four home runs over the last six games. You know, we've talked... It's Vlad. So we've talked about him a ton this year where, you know, the cold start and then the contact profile really came around. You know, at this point, even with an 816 OPS, like he's like near the top among American League first baseman in batting average, OBP, you know, a whole wins above replacement, like a bunch of stats. First base around Major League Baseball is bleak right now for some reason. So in relative terms, it's been all right. It's still not, you know, like Vladimir Guerrero Jr., even after this hot streak, is on pace for 22 home runs. Everyone would agree that they need a little bit more of that. What have you seen over the last week or so? Is this just a, you know, the outcome of what you and I were kind of saying a month ago, which is, well, get Vlad back to being Vlad as a hitter and the power is going to come? Or have you seen, you know, more of a search for that power?
This is the best he's looked in a long time for me. Really is. Even some of the contact that's not turning into base hits, and my God, I'm starting to sound like some of the folks I interview every day. The contact is really good. It's all hard. Go back to that Boston series, not just the home runs, but that deep extra base hit he had to center field that would have been out if it wasn't into that nook of the stadium. He is smoking everything. Like, post-haircut Vladdy is a dangerous man. He looks fantastic right now. Now, yeah, you want that to turn into home runs. Those are what are going to turn losses into wins. That's what could really lead to a hot streak. Because anything, Blake, about this team right now needs to be within the context of how can they win 8 games in a row. They've got to do something crazy like that at this point. Vladdy hitting 4 home runs in those 8 games is a damn good way to try. And if he can go on some sort of power surge, I know he's not going to hit 50, but if he can hit a few in a stretch and start to carry this team a bit more, that's one of those rare avenues where this can work. He looks really good. And for months now, when we ask John Schneider about Vladdy, he keeps saying it's all about pitch selection. It's the pitches that he is choosing to swing at. And, you know, as I'm learning with George Springer, if John Schneider continues to say something over and over and over, he's probably got a reason. And we're seeing that a little more lately from Vladdy, where we're not seeing, and we've talked about this a lot, like that low and away slider that he flails at and is not close to. We haven't seen much of that lately. He just really needs to eliminate that one gross swing out of his game. As long as it's near the plate, it doesn't need to be over the heart of the plate. As long as he can get a bat on it, you see what the exit velocities are. You see the power. A little more loft would turn into more home runs, of course. But Vladdy's still the guy. Nobody has the ceiling he has. And if they're going to go on any sort of run, he's got to be the guy having a ridiculous hot streak. I think that's the one way this could happen.
Yeah, you mentioned the, you know, spitting on that slider low and away, for example. It wasn't a slider last night, but right before he hit that home run, he takes a fastball, a 3-1 fastball that is probably a ball on that lower outside edge, thinks he gets a walk. And that's one where, like, in a 3-1 count, like, that's probably ball four, so it's probably a good swing decision because it's ball four. But also, like, what are you going to do with that, right? Like, that's not – and he had swung at a bad fastball earlier in that count, too, so a nice adjustment there to see it again. And then, yeah, get a – I mean, that the pitch he hit for a home run was also not a strike, but it was not a strike right in the sweet spot there in a little bit on the hands. And there was one the other day, too, where he checked the swing and even did the – he called himself safe – down to first base. And Vlad makes the calls on the bases a lot of the times too, and isn't always correct. But that to me shows, you know, he's pretty locked in. He knows where his mechanics are. He knows where the ball is and things like that. I have to turn it to a bit of a negative from this one. And I don't know if you put the journalism hat on and done the reporting on this just yet, or if this is a pregame thing today. What did Isaiah Kiner-Falefa do to the Yankees on his way out at the end of last season?
Yeah.
3 hit by a pitch in one game.
This one I have to ask IKF about today. That was strange to me. Now, everyone likes IKF. I don't think there's anything bad happening there. But I loved how serious he was about all of it. The first two looked identical. They hit him in the back foot. And it was as if he was expecting it. Like, it was almost a scripted TV show where he would take it, flip off his gear, throw his bat in the exact same way. The clips looked identical. And then the last one, I think, was off the elbow, the upper arm. So when Isaiah came to Toronto from New York, what surprised me the most, Blake, is that I got texts from a few people in New York media, known as cuddly, lovely folks, saying, "This is a great guy. You're really going to love covering him." That's not an empty compliment, you know, coming from folks in the New York market. A lot of respect for this guy. So I don't think that this was a case of hating on IKF. I think it was some crazy coincidence. We'll see how much ice he has in himself today. But, man, he took those hit-by-pitches as calmly and unbothered as possible. You know, anything like that, I would be in an ambulance immediately. But he did not seem to flinch. It was like he was getting wiffle balled up there. It was amazing.
All right, so that was the stuff from the game. We'll see Marcus Stroman tonight, which should be entertaining as well. Let's talk about the thing that happened before the game. It was the Ross Atkins media availability. And, you know, it's it's one of those things. I talked about it before on the show yesterday before it happened. It's another one of those things like, what is he going to say? Like, we know what he's going to say. Yeah. We could give the answers coming in. Yes, I'll poke fun a little bit at some of the consultants speak on Twitter or whatever. But the reality is, we've known that they're not going to make that sell decision until closer to the end of July if they ultimately have to make it. And then you have to say what you have to say otherwise. Was there anything from the media availability that you took away that you didn't feel you already knew or had already had the right perspective on?
No. And going in, I think I agreed with you, Blake, of what's going to be different here. I would have been more interested probably to hear Ross's thoughts a few weeks from now, a little closer to the deadline, and maybe we will again when this becomes a bit clearer, because what are we, still close to 5 weeks out from the deadline? Even if the Blue Jays were five more games in the wrong direction, you're still going to say, come on, maybe we can win 10 in a row. Maybe we can get this back on track, because there's no reason to sell early. Not a lot of teams do. You might as well hold out for that miracle. But in a lot of senses, Blake, this kind of feels like the, whether it's yours or a friend's relationship that everyone else can kind of tell has gone in the wrong way, but the people involved in it can't quite. Everyone can see where the season is headed right now. And barring a miracle, it's kind of like watching Blue Jays fans wait for the team to come to that same realization at this point. And very clearly headed in the direction of selling. Yes, I get that eight straight wins can change that really quickly. The three wild cards in each league do not raise the bar all that high. You don't need to be a super team here to make a postseason run. But I think everything was as I expected. Some of the words were different and contained one more syllable than I expected. But that's about it. And the Blue Jays, where they are right now, Blake, I think it's just about avoiding getting stuck in the middle. The only fear I would have for this organization is getting stuck in the middle and trying to sort of kind of make next year work. I think they need to go left or right. And it's pretty clear that one of those is a more attractive option at this point, given the record. But getting stuck in the middle, that's how you start to limit the upside of 26, 27, 28, beyond. And that's where it can get a little dangerous, because we've seen in this market what a team stuck in the middle looks like for a lot of years. And I think that's their biggest decision right now. What does 2025 mean? Are you going to try to do it one more time with Vladdy and Bo? Or are you going to look at this team that has not worked yet and say, we've really got to make a serious move?
And, you know, Ross Atkins, again, was on Blair and Barker yesterday, and you can go check that out in the Blair and Barker podcast feed if you missed it. But he pushed back on, you know, hey, it's still realistic for extensions to happen for those guys, and maybe that colors things. But, yeah, you know, when he said two or three different angles was the exact phrasing that he used yesterday. And one is obviously they get good enough over the next 5 weeks. They go on a run that we maybe don't – it's not a high likelihood run, but the possibility is not zero, and suddenly they're around 500. They're a couple games out of the wild card, whatever, and they do a modest buy. That's one angle. The other angle is like, yeah, they sell it all off because they're not going to do it, and they've lost face. And then it's that the mystery third angle of like, you hold or you do something that's just not really significant. And Atkins said yesterday on Blair and Barker that they have not received, and maybe this was actually at the presser and not on Blair and Barker, but they have not received a lot of calls specifically on their expiring free agent guys yet. It's just been about teams trying to download their strategic intent, which is, I believe that's a direct quote. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm with you that the middle ground is a tough one, and not to bleed sports because they operate differently and there's a cap in one and there's not in the other, et cetera. But we're coming off of a period with the Raptors right now where people seem happy about the last couple of days because all of the moves have been, whether you like the individual player price tag or whatever, they've been oriented around this is the path and the timeline and the plan. And now everything can fit within that. Trying to do both things carried a cost for a little bit. And I do worry that the Jays will try to do that. Again, different sports, different flexibility around cap and things like that. But, you know, if you're trying to do two things, your ability to do either one is compromised. No, that's not a personal comment. That's about the actual teams. So yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. So what is, we've talked about this, but like, what do the next couple of weeks have to look like for you, you know, standings wise or wildcard wise, for them to avoid one of those lesser angles? Like Ben Nicholson-Smith has kicked around the 5% playoff odds numbers. I've talked to people at FanGraphs or Baseball Prospectus who think that's probably closer to 10%. Like, any team below 10%, even in the current environment, should probably, hey, look toward next year. What is that in terms of a games behind or record or something like that? Like, when you're in that Texas Heat for All-Star, what are you looking at in the standings?
I think they would need to be within a few games of a spot to realistically push in or even kind of tinker in the middle. And even at that point, Blake, you're getting into organizational philosophy of, can this work? You know, do you believe in your own record? Forget what Ross says to us publicly, what the front office says to us publicly. When they sit down and have meetings, do they believe that it will actually get better? That's the big question they need to answer. What are they going to bet on? This organization has made some big bets in recent years. They have bet on swinging towards defense and pitching. They have bet on running it back when it failed once. It's currently failing again. So they've got, it's like a betting history like me on West Coast NBA games, Blake. It's not good so far. But they need to answer that question themselves. How much do they actually believe in this? And you need to be realistic. The wrinkle in all of this is that this is a front office that's also trying to stick around. There's a professional aspect to all of this as well, where people are trying to save their jobs. And I do not mean this in a negative way or as a shot. A lot of people in any work are in positions where they're trying to save their jobs and do things that create opportunities for them to stay and keep making that salary, keep in that market. So there's a lot of factors here, not just on the field, but off the field as well. And the literal field itself, those tickets don't sell themselves. Those fancy, fancy box seats that are about to open in a couple of weeks do not sell themselves. Those are expensive. So there needs to be some sort of team to sell people on as well. There's a lot of factors here, and that's not normally a good thing, but they've got to avoid the middle. And I think if they are down in that 10% or less range, reset the franchise. You don't get many opportunities to do it. And looking a year down the road, yeah, Chris Bassett, Kevin Gausman, Vladdy, Bo, a lot of these guys, maybe there's more value. But in baseball, you need to wonder, maybe it gets worse. And a lot of the last few years, things have gotten worse that they hoped would get better. And that needs to be a lesson.
Yeah, worrying things could get worse is that's the sweet spot for me right there.
That's why we do it, baby.
Yeah, and then look, the reality of this is, you know, Hazel May asked Bo Bichette yesterday, would you be surprised if you were moved at the deadline? And he said, not surprised at all. And that you know, is Bo being honest? I know some people interpret that quote different ways, but that's just an honest take. We heard from Kevin Gausman similarly a couple months ago now that if they don't turn it around. So these guys know, Keegan, and I'll let you go here. But these guys know what's on the line. And, you know, our own people here at Sportsnet have said for the first time that they can remember, nobody's untouchable. So going to be an interesting couple of games, couple of weeks here, buddy.
We'll see, Blake. We'll see. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, man. Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com, all around good dude. We're going to continue to set up the rest of this series. A lot of interesting stuff on the Yankees side as they have now lost 7 of 8 and fallen out of first in the American League East. So to run you down, we'll talk to Ryan Rucco next. We're going to talk to Jorge Castillo of ESPN about it as well. We've got Russell Carlton coming on the show from Baseball Prospectus a little later. And one of the newest Buffalo Bisons, one of the Blue Jays' fastest rising prospects, Alan Roden, will join us at 11. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win 9-2 last night. It's the seventh loss in the last 8 games for the New York Yankees, who have been the class of the league to this point, but maybe some of their injury troubles and things like that catching up to them a little bit. They do have, obviously, Anthony Rizzo and Giancarlo Stanton on the IL, as well as like a whole pitching staff worth of guys. Let's get the pulse of the Yankees from Ryan Rucco of ESPN and Yes Network and several Emmy Awards and everything else, my New York Liberty. Ryan, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, happy to do it, man. Thank you for having me.
You got the Brooklyn Nets shirt on there. I got to ask you about that first. The Mikal Bridges trade, man, and draft night. Busy, busy week on the Brooklyn Nets side as well. How do you feel about how all that shook out?
Yeah, you know, when you're traveling, you know, with the team, they usually give you a little gear that you can work out in. So it's about to be workout time. I do about 20, 25 Nets games. And I think that, you know, the Nets were honest about the place that they're in, which is they had to pick a direction. Mikal Bridges was not going to be enough for this team to compete. I think that became very clear based on what we saw last season. And the Nets needed to kind of decide, okay, do we have enough assets to be able to bring in another star around Bridges that could make this a contender? Or do we use Mikal Bridges to really do this rebuild fully and correctly? And I think they realized there wasn't going to be the big piece to bring in next to Bridges that could make them a contender, that they were going to have to go this direction. And then it was, okay, what's the most you could extract for Bridges? And I think one thing that became very clear to me last year watching Mikal is, you know, this is not a guy who's a 1A or a 1B on a contending team, right? That's not his game. That's not his personality. But in the right situation with the right players around him, he is an outstanding, let's say, number three. And so even though his value to the Nets as a number one wasn't, you know, any longer as significant as we may have projected it to be initially, to a team like the Knicks, he has great value because they do have the incumbent pieces needed to get the most out of Mikal. So I think it's a great trade for the Knicks because of the place that they're in and his availability, especially with all the injuries they've dealt with, and just them trying to get another high-quality two-way basketball player, plus the connection to all the Villanova guys, and obviously they've all been their best selves with each other. And then for the Nets, I think it's a really good deal too, because you got a lot more than, say, like a supersized role player would normally garner, right? Usually you wouldn't get five first round picks and a swap for a player like Mikal Bridges. So even though it hurt a little bit probably to send him cross town, I think the Nets did incredibly well with what they got back.
Yeah, it's a big haul. And now you look back to the KD trade and it's really more like, hey, you got like eight firsts for KD or whatever it works out to there. So fun times for those New York teams, and as much as it might pain us a little bit here in Toronto, always rooting for OG Anunoby. So, and hey, it's it's an anyone but the Celtics situation here for me. So go Knicks until the Raptors kind of get back on their own climb there. Ryan, on the baseball side, this is a Yankees team that when we looked ahead to this series, I thought I'd be talking to you about one of the best teams in baseball, team at the top of the American League. They're obviously still very good, but they've dropped 7 of 8 here. They've fallen out of first in the American League East for the first time in a while. I know some of this is, you know, probably the toll of injuries catching up on them and things like that. What have you seen over these last 2 weeks where the Yankees have kind of lost the handle a little bit here?
You know, I think first and foremost, just their pitching was great, like incredible. They set a franchise record for most consecutive starts to begin a season with a starter going at least 4 innings, which, you know, it's only 4 innings, but still to have 70 plus games in a row to begin the year where that happens.
In 2024 too.
Yeah, exactly. So it was very significant. And the starting pitching, first and foremost, just hasn't been as good over the last 2 weeks. Not only has it not been as good, it's been, you know, basically dreadful over the last 2 weeks. I think their starters ERA now is around 8 or 9 over the last 2 weeks after they had been, you know, allowing the fewest runs in baseball. Prior to that, they've allowed the most runs in baseball over their last 13 games. And I also think that puts more pressure on an offense, right? It's a lot different having an at-bat when you're already in a 7-0 hole than it is in a 0-0 game or a 1-run game or a 2-run game. The injuries have definitely played a role. Giancarlo Stanton's presence in the lineup, as well as his production, is really missed. He was having a great season. And as that third hard bopper behind Soto and Judge. I think, you know, he's just so significant. And then you've had, you know, Rizzo look like he was starting to come out of it, even though he struggled this year. Then he gets hurt. Torres, after a rough start, had been really good for 3 or 4 weeks. Now all of a sudden, you know, he goes in the gutter with his production. Alex Verdugo, who has been a really nice fit for this lineup. He happens to get cold at this time. I don't think there's any worries about him coming out of it. It's just, you know, the timing of his slump is unfortunate. But I do think this, you know, as much as some of these struggles are like the nature of a baseball season and some injuries, you know, piling up at the same time, it also shined a light on some things the Yankees need. They need some help in the bullpen, without question. They need a couple significant strikeout arms. They have some guys coming back from injury, Scott Efros being one of them who's fairly close. But they probably are going to have to add externally there too. And then I think they do need help in the infield, whether that's first, third, or second. They just have not gotten the requisite production they need from LeMahieu, Rizzo, Torres, Cabrera, to feel like this is a you know, championship caliber team if that's not addressed in some way. So this stretch might actually have come at a good time, because as great as they were playing, it's probably good for them to have a light shine on that before they get to the trade deadline.
And plus, you know, it doesn't hurt when you're obviously this is a very, very good team. But yeah, it had, you know, Rizzo, Berti, Stanton, Judge all stayed healthy until just after the trade deadline. And you've got a bunch of 34 and 35 year olds, probably better to address the depth. And yeah, you'd rather just address it. But you're right. This is probably better timing there. You mentioned Alex Verdugo cooled off a little bit, but like you said, had been a pretty good fit there. Are you still adjusting to him being clean cut? Because like I can't. Every time I see him, I'm like, what the heck, man? I can't get used to it.
Man, you know what? I think after all the years watching Yankees and broadcasting them now too, you do get used to it, because there's so many guys. I mean, once Johnny Damon became clean cut, I think you're going to be able to get used to anything else. Like once his Tom Hanks and Castaway beard was gone, I think we can get used to basically anyone else.
Okay, so last night, Jays beat the Yankees 9-2. That's a couple iffy ones in a row now for Carlos Rodon. Credit to him. He still gave them length. He was able to go over 100 pitches, save that bullpen a little bit. I'm sure that was really valued. We had that interesting moment where I think it was Bickford coming out of the pen. He ran onto the field, but Rodon wasn't ready to come off yet. That is a couple shaky ones of late for Carlos Rodon, though. Where should the concern level be with him over these last handful of starts? I think it's what, 20 earned runs over his last three.
Yeah, and he had pitched to like a 2.93 his first 12 starts or 14 starts, whatever it was, and now these last I think it's 14, and then these last three starts. Yeah, he's gotten hit hard. You know, his fastball location just hasn't been good enough early in these games, and he's gotten ambushed. It happened against the Red Sox. It happened against the Braves. And it happened last night with George Springer. And I think, you know, some of that in the beginning of the game was bad luck. You know, he gives up a ground ball just under the glove of Volpe. 1-2 pitch, he hits Kiner Falefa. Vlad breaks his bat, happens to loop a double. Then that ball down the line that hits first base, and it's like 2-0, and you're like, wait, I haven't even given up a hard hit ball. What's going on? And then it snowballed from there. I think there's concern because of last year, right, where Rodon was dreadful last season. This year, you hope that because he has pitched really well up till these last three starts, that gives him enough of a base to say, hey, who I really am is not last year. It's those first 14 starts this year and the years prior to last year, right? And this is just a rough stretch, and I'm going to be able to get through this. I think that what he did the final three innings yesterday was significant. John Flaherty talked about this on the broadcast with me, how, like, you know, sometimes you want to stay in there to try and figure some things out. Felt like he did with his cutter, with his changeup, with some of his backdoor breaking balls, even then staying in the situation you're talking about in the fifth inning, to get out of that jam and to complete five, to save the bullpen a little bit. You hope that gives him a mental boost and an emotional boost going into his next start, where he can feel a little good about something in a start that overall, obviously, you would not feel good about at all. But I think there is concern because there's not enough history here in this uniform of success yet to make you feel like it's definitely turning back in the right direction. I'm really curious to see his next start, because I have a feeling he's going to be very good, and I have a feeling he's going to point back to the way he pitched the final three innings of the start last night, which of course, like, Yankee fans would never want to hear because he gave up 8 runs. It's like, you know, but it's not an excuse. It's a micro within a macro, right? And those micros, I think what he pulled out of it could be significant moving forward.
Yeah, and hey, you don't have to teach. 37-43 for the Blue Jays. It's been a season of trying to find those little micros that might get built on for something a little later. Someone who's had lots to continue to build on since arriving to the Yankees at the in the offseason, Marcus Stroman. He's a guy we know well in Toronto. I love watching him pitch. I know he can be a bit of a divisive personality, but I've always been a fan, like seeing him out there. No, he didn't have, his last two starts were against Boston and Atlanta, so of course they're not going to be like unbelievable, but he's sporting a 3.15 ERA coming in here. It really seems from afar that he's been a really good fit. What have you liked about Stroman with the Yankees?
Yeah, I'm like you. I'm a big fan of Marcus. I've liked him for a long time. I've gotten along with him great for years. I like how much of a competitor he is, first and foremost. This is someone who takes his craft very seriously. I also like, specifically with his time with the Yankees, he's really embraced the history of the organization and just loving wearing the pinstripes. And, you know, he's constantly wearing these throwback retro shirts from different championship Yankee teams in the 90s and then in 2000, and really has leaned into being a Yankee and embracing their history. And then also, I think, creating a really awesome atmosphere, helping to create an awesome atmosphere for the starting pitching staff in the clubhouse. You know, he's a guy who's very thoughtful, who's very zen. And I think he's brought a lot of that, you know, cerebral nature to the clubhouse. And the guys have vibed off of it. You know, they burn candles the days of their start, something that he started and everyone else kind of picked up on in the clubhouse. And he's just fit really well. Like, the guys love him in there. And I think he's been a positive influence across the board.
That's great. That's it's good to hear. I hope he gets rocked tonight, obviously. But it's nice to hear that's been a good fit. So this is a Jays team. I mentioned it's been a season of us trying to pull those micros that they can build on. You know, we're looking at at George Springer's game yesterday and hoping he can turn things around. You know, they've won two in a row here, which is not enough to say in a row. But when you just dropped 7 in a row, it feels like a big deal. I know you don't get to be quite as locked in because we don't play divisional opponents 19 times a year anymore. But what have your impressions been of this Jays team from afar as you prepped for this series, as you talked to people around the game?
Kind of just feels like a year where everything that could go wrong has, right? Like, there certainly are some roster deficiencies, and you guys obviously miss the bats of Gurriel and Teoscar Hernandez and what they provided to this offense around those other, young core bats. But you also, you know, you're not expecting George Springer at 34 years old to struggle the way he struggled, right? You're not expecting Bo Bichette to struggle the way he struggled. Even Vlad, you know, he's been good, but he hasn't been as dominant as we can see him offensively. And then you add into the mix the starting pitching, even some guys who have been okay, you know, being okay instead of really good, when we know they're capable of being really good, like a Gausman. Then you take a couple of your, you know, back end relievers, and between either injury or ineffectiveness, like, nobody's expecting Swanson to have to go to AAA, you know, Romano being hurt the way he's been. So it just, to me, it feels like we could probably seriously look at this Toronto team stalling out in their ascent. I think that's a fair macro assessment of them, and saying, like, hey, have they done what they need to do to get past where they've been the last couple of years? Like, it doesn't feel like they have. But I also think you could say, like, that's true. I also don't think they're as bad as their record's been this year. And they probably are, you know, a borderline playoff team. The question is that good enough? You know, you've been in the playoffs, you know, three of the last 4 years, haven't really built the team to the point of feeling like you're advancing past that. If you're not going to, how are you going to get there? Are you getting there by tearing something more significant down? Like, are you going to trade one of your core pieces, or are you going to say, no, like, they're still at the foundation of our success? Let's see, you know, if we can kind of like grind through the rest of the season and then reevaluate in the off season, because this team as constructed obviously is not winning a World Series. You know, at this point, you've had enough trips to the playoffs over the last few years that that no longer is satisfactory. At the same time, I look at the team on the field that they have and I say, yeah, I could still see them being a team that ends up, you know, 5, 7, 8 games over 500 by the end of the year. So I think they just have to kind of decide what is the priority.
Yeah, it's a tough one. In these next couple weeks, 4 against the Yankees, 4 against the Astros, a little road trip before the All-Star break. That it's pretty crucial couple of weeks here. Ryan, before I let you go, 1 year ago today, you called Domingo Herman's perfect game. I know, yeah. Look, we're the same age, but you have accomplished like the list of things you've done, Emmys you've won, cool games you got to do, much longer than mine. Is the Domingo Herman perfect game top of the list? Like, is that number one for you that you've gotten to do so far?
That probably is, yeah, number one on just like the broadcast experience list. You know, calling the women's Final Four the last couple of years with Caitlin Clark and everything that came with that is also way up there. And those games against, you know, LSU and South Carolina, but the perfect game, because it's just so rare. And I grew up a diehard Yankee fan and like remembering exactly where I was when Wells threw his and Cone threw his, and getting to be a part of that history. And I also had one of my best friends in the world, Justin Shackle, was in the radio booth that night calling it. So for us both to be there, we had gone on like a 2-hour walk around San Francisco that morning. Like it just like the context of all of it was just, it was incredible. And, you know, I think the thing is, you know, when you call championship moments, they're all unique and special and feel big because they're championship moments. Right. But we know every single year there's going to be a champion, whatever sport you're doing. Right. It doesn't mean it doesn't feel unique because it does every single time. But the thing that was so unique about that experience is as it's unfolding and happening, you're able to kind of process like this probably is the only time in my life that this could happen. Right. Because perfect games just don't happen.
No.
You know, so there was one point at the end of the broadcast where Jeff Nelson was like, are you nervous? And I was like, cause he saw me like, you know, shaking, like he was wondering if I was nervous about like broadcasting it and like nailing the call. And I was like, I'm not nervous about broadcasting it. I'm nervous about it happening because I just knew this was it. This was the shot for it to happen. And so, yeah, it's number one on the list. The aftermath of that, the glow after that, like I like to talk about in our business, you get a broadcast high. It's a performance high. Anybody who's even acted in a play as a kid knows that feeling of like when you get done with a play and like you just have this performance high, or if you're a musical performer, your show, whatever it is, we get that in broadcasting. And that post performance high lasted a full week. Like I felt like I was buzzing off that game for a week. And then obviously looking back on it, even beyond that, and then getting to share, well, my friends and family are big Yankee fans. So yeah, man, I can't believe it's been a year, but pretty incredible.
That sounds awesome. And you know, I don't know if it'll top it, but I hope you get to call a championship for our New York Liberty this year as well. 15-3.
I love your hat, man.
Thanks, man.
I love the hat. I love it. It's great. Hey, they're well positioned. They got a great squad and Barclays Center is just the atmosphere for these Liberty games is unbelievable.
Yeah, that's great, man. I love you on the call for those as well. Thanks so much for taking the time out, Ryan. Enjoy the rest of the series.
All right, thanks so much. I appreciate you having me.
Ryan Rucco, ESPN and YES Network. Yeah, the list of Emmys is long. The list of different broadcasts is long. If we had more time, I'd just be like, man, how do you manage it over several years to balance not just basketball and baseball, but also mix the WNBA in there? It's a difficult job he does, and he does it very, very well. So we're going to see more of Jay's Yankees tonight. We're going to continue teeing that one up for you. We'll talk to Jorge Castillo of ESPN later in the show to get a little bit more inside the Yankees here. Tee up Marcus Stroman against Yusei Kikuchi, former ace against current ace, obviously. I will talk to Russell Carlton of Baseball Prospectus as well. But coming up after the break, one of the fastest rising prospects in the Toronto Blue Jays system recently got promoted from AA to AAA. Just a tremendous approach at the plate and by all accounts, a very smart guy. Alan Roden of the Buffalo Bisons joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafs land. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. I'm not sure if Warden Ziders is still our next guest's walk-up music, but I know it was at one point. We're joined now by Buffalo Bisons outfielder and one of the top prospects in the Toronto Blue Jays system, Alan Roden. Alan, good morning. Thank you for doing this with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Is Ride the Lightning still the walk-up song?
It is.
Okay, good.
Gotta ride with it.
Good, man. You've had a handful of games up in Buffalo now. How has that been? How's the promotion been? How's the first few games getting your feet wet gone?
Yeah, you know, it's been a great experience so far. It's been a lot of fun just to, you know, transition in AAA and you know, get this new challenge going. Get to play with some new teammates that got to play with a little bit last year in New Hampshire when I got the call up. So it's been a great experience so far for sure.
There are no umpires listening, so you won't get in trouble for this. Were you safe at second base last night?
You know, I think if there was review, like they have in the big leagues, I think I could have gotten a safe call, but, the ball beat me. So I don't blame him for calling me out at all.
That's all right. That's a very political answer, man. Okay, so you've gotten the call up. What were those conversations like? Like, how'd you find out you were getting bumped to AAA? What's the process been kind of getting acclimated to a new spot?
The conversation was, you know, after the game in New Hampshire at home. I think it was, I don't know, a couple of Thursdays ago. It was just got called in the coach's office and got the promotion, which was extremely exciting. And then, you know, the transition was, you know, traveled the next day and moved into the clubhouse and, you know, got to meet up with some of the new teammates and reunite with some of the older teammates that I had last year, like I said. And then, you know, the transition into the baseball is, you know, you do everything you can to adjust. You know, pitchers are executing. And so just doing everything I can to continue to get better and adjust.
Is there much difference in terms of like what resources the Bisons have? You know, obviously the coaches are different and stuff like that, but how you're doing your work, how you're prepping, is that all more or less the same, or does that change a little bit with Buffalo's too?
Facilities in Buffalo are, you know, quite good. You know, because of the renovations they had to do in 2020. And so, you know, everything else is the same other than the facilities are just, you know, that much expanded. The clubhouse is amazing and, you know, obviously field's very nice at Solomon Field and, you know, the cages are awesome. So, but the work itself is the same, obviously.
So you mentioned some of those teammates who have helped you that you saw in New Hampshire last year, earlier in the minor league system. How close are you and Will Robertson? Cause there's a Creighton connection there as well. And then you guys, I know you haven't spent a lot of time on the same rosters in the Jays system, but Creighton Blue Jays, Toronto Blue Jays, you guys have been around, it seems.
Exactly right. Honestly, Will is my role model, one of my role models for sure. You know, he was the guy at Creighton when I was a freshman, you know, just trying to learn how to play at the university. And so I learned a lot from Will. You know, I'm still learning a lot from Will. He's such a awesome dude and an awesome hitter, awesome baseball player. And so you know, he's someone I really look up to and aspire to be like. And so, you know, just getting to talk with him every day and be around him is just such a positive for me. And so, it's been great.
We see it a little bit in the highlights. Obviously he's a home run hitter. He had that hot finish to last year. And then the Arizona Fall League, he's kind of carried it over. Just how serious is that power when you see him like in BP or in the cages and stuff?
Oh, it's so legit. You know, it's you can't not see it. You know, even the ones that don't go out, it's just smashed, you know, everywhere on every pitch, basically in BP. It's really fun to watch. And, you know, it truly is legit.
So we're about 2 years removed. The draft is coming up here. You have moved through the system pretty quickly in just 2 years here. What do you remember about your draft process, the time leading up to this? I know you've spoke before that, hey, there are a handful of teams interested in you. Take us through your draft memories and getting the word that you were going Blue Jays to Blue Jays.
Yeah, I was still playing baseball in the time of the draft. I was in the Cape Cod Summer Baseball League, so yeah, I was still playing, and so I think maybe that made it a little bit different than if I was just, you know, kind of waiting around for the draft. I think it probably made it a little bit easier. There's a little bit of that distraction and still focus on the game itself instead of, you know, how high can I go or all the other stuff that goes along with the draft. But, you know, just a lot of uncertainty, you know, like you just said, you know, kind of the pool of teams that are interested in you and stuff like that. But a little bit of uncertainty, and that's, I guess, the good and bad of the draft. You know, that's what's tough, but that's also what's really exciting about it.
Okay, so it's been a little under 2 years. You're already in AAA. You get that kind of cup of coffee, the 2025 games with Dunedin. And then last year you go two levels. This year you're already on two levels. What do you think it has been that's made you able to kind of elevate? You know, I know you're 24, but that's still pretty quick for especially for a hitter to kind of move through the minors. Why do you think you've been able to do that so swiftly?
Yeah, I just think it's you know, the stuff that I learned in college and at Creighton University of consistency and preparation. I think those two things are in the game of baseball are things that are non-negotiables if you are, you know, looking towards having some success on a daily basis. So just having consistency in the work, having preparation before the game, during the game, staying ready to go and being ready to play. Those are things that I've learned throughout the years playing ball, especially at Creighton and definitely in pro ball, because pro ball is definitely a little bit different than college because you have to play every single day. But, you know, those two things are really the most important things is the consistency in the work every day before the game and then the preparation to play right before the game and during the game.
When I talk to people in the organization or scouts outside the organization, the first thing they bring up about you is your approach at the plate. And, you know, that can be, you know, swing decisions or, you know, walk rate, strikeout rate, waiting on stuff that you can actually drive. What does that mean to you, having a good approach at the plate when you hear that about yourself or what you think a good approach at the plate is?
Yeah, I think it's having a plan against a specific pitcher you're facing. Knowing what you could get, knowing what you might get in your at bat, but then also knowing the situation of the game, because you know if your team needs a base hit, just a base hit to score a run, they need a ground ball to advance a runner, they need a walk to start kind of a little rally they have going on because you know you may be down a few runs and you can't hit a 6-run home run or a 5-run home run, and so. I think it's having a plan against the pitcher you're facing, but then also knowing the situation of the game and having a, you know, a mature approach about it and not just trying to, you know, hit the cover of the ball every single time. Although you probably want to do that if you could.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that'd be great. When it comes to that power I mean, that's something that, you know, you flash. I know you've hit a handful of home runs already this year. Is that something that you are conscious of and like work on, or is that, hey, if I have a good approach and I put good swings, the power is going to come? Like how do you kind of mentally figure out the power side of the game?
I definitely think it's a combination of those two. You know, having the good approach will allow you to get to some moves that you might not be able to if you have a poor approach, right? And when I say moves is your swing and how you move on baseball, move on a specific pitch. But then also it's also about, do I even have the ability to hit a ball like that, hit a home run, physically hit a home run? So it's definitely a combination of consciously working in, you know, the cages or wherever it is on the actual physical movement of the swing. And then, you know, obviously in a game, having the approach to allow yourself to have access to that in a game.
So as you kind of go up a level here, obviously one of the differences with AAA is these are guys with more major league experience in some cases, maybe a little bit more stuff. What are you expecting from how are pitchers going to come at me? How are they going to try to challenge me standpoint?
Yeah, I think what comes with a little bit more experience on the pitcher side is they know what they're looking at with the data that they have, and they have the ability to execute their plan every single time or on a more consistent basis than you know, a younger pitcher might have. And so for me, it's exposing the things that I don't do well. And so I think how I plan to go about attacking that is knowing those weaknesses and doing everything I can to have those weaknesses come to the surface the least amount of times possible, while trying to get to my strengths as much as possible.
So I know that, you know, part of this is even when things are going well, you've got to be ready to adjust and things like that. Mechanically, it looks like your swing's a little different than it was last year. What went into that decision? What are you trying to accomplish by changing things up there a little bit? When again, things have been going really well too.
Yeah, the whole purpose is you know, continuing to try to get better. I think some of the things that I was doing last year was really bringing some statistic success. However, you know, I think I was fairly limited by some of the things that I was doing mechanically. And so the changes were to, you know, continue to get better with that, allow a little bit more space, a little bit more freedom in the swing and to tap into a little bit more power that might've been hidden away because of the mechanical issues that were there. So, you know, obviously that was the reasoning behind switching it up. You know, those are the conversations I had with Blue Jays hitting coaches. And so it's, you know, it's a work in progress, but obviously, you know, I'm happy with some of the things that we've done.
Away from the plate, you've also had some pretty good success stealing bases since you went pro. 36 for 42, I think is the number. Is that one that, you know, how do I word this? Is the success rate really high because you're selective on when you go, or could you run a little bit more, do you think?
I definitely think I could run a little bit more. And the success rate is definitely because it's selective. You know, I'll never call myself a really, really fast guy. you know, there's a little bit of speed there, maybe a little bit of a first step quickness, but nothing ridiculous. So for me, it's just about picking my spots and being smart about it. And, you know, I think that's something I'm continuing to learn and be a little bit more aggressive and take a little bit more chances. But, you know, that's definitely something that I'm continuing to work through and can you try to get better at for sure.
So this is not a Blue Jays related question, but I know you grew up a Brewers fan. Is there anyone, I mean, I guess, do you still get a kick out of the fact that, you know, obviously you got to be a Jays fan now, but the Brewers in first place, they're in the National League. That's that doesn't conflict with the Jays. And then did you have any like favorite Brewers growing up that you looked at and kind of, you know, try to pull from your game or just favorite guys in general?
It was actually great for me watching the Blue Jays when they were playing the Brewers earlier this year at it's AmFam Field now. I know it as Miller Park.
Same.
But Prince Fielder, Ryan Braun, those are the guys growing up. I think my Instagram handle is Alan Roden 28 because of Prince Fielder. That was my favorite number growing up, and obviously big lefty, hit a lot of home runs, and Ryan Braun was so good for such a long time. And I mean, he had the steroid thing, but he was still a great player. So, yeah, those were my guys for sure.
Does anyone have 28 on the Bisons? You take that back.
I don't know. I was handed 58.
Okay.
Which you don't get to choose.
Yeah.
I didn't get to pick. That doesn't bother me too much. You know, I'll just play with whatever I can get, but, yeah, I'm not sure if anyone's 28.
Yeah, I'm sure it's got to be once you get the call to the show, you get to pick your own number if it's available, right? Would you go 28 or would you would you keep it 58 because hey, that's what you've been wearing?
I'm pretty superstitious.
Okay.
So I think I'd have to put some thought into it. But hey, if 58 works, might as well keep it.
Yeah, working for you so far, man. It's nice to see you up at AAA. Nice to get to talk to you a little bit, get to know you. Keep up the great work, man, and thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alan Roden of the Buffalo Bisons. They beat Syracuse last night 5-1. And yeah, his pal Will Robertson hit another home run in that game. The Bisons, we don't usually get a 5-1 score. There's not usually a one on there, but they're always entertaining games. They had a weekend of games where it was 9-4, 21-10, 18-9, 10-2. Those were the scores over the last couple. They are at home against Syracuse this weekend. Obviously, the Blue Jays are at home as well. But if you're close to that Buffalo border, those games are always a blast to jump over the border and go to. And they always, because it's minor league baseball, they always have lots of cool stuff going on. Today is the Lego Ninja Go Play Like Ninja free building event today, whatever that means. There are fireworks at the game. Tomorrow is a celebrate the summer, pennant and bucket hat giveaway. Sunday is Princess Day at the ballpark. You see what I mean here? There's a lot of fun, silly stuff that they do down at those Bisons game, in addition to letting you see some of these future Toronto Blue Jays like Alan Roden, soon Ricky Tiedemann, Will Robertson, guys like that, and the guys who you now know a little bit from this Toronto Blue Jays team, Spencer Horwitz, Ernie Clement, David Schneider, Addison Barger, the guys who have been down there a little while lately. Not a lot of updates from down on the farm yesterday. Obviously, the main update yesterday was that Varsho was back in the lineup. We haven't got the latest on Jimmy Garcia or Jordan Romano. I think because Ross Atkins spoke yesterday, usually the first game of the series is a bit of a kind of news dump day, but it being an Atkins talk day, maybe change things up a little bit there. So we'll probably get some updates on them today before this series gets going. Joey Votto didn't play yesterday, but he continues to work his way back between the Florida Complex League and Dunedin, and is probably, I believe Atkins said, you know, a couple weeks away, but he's feeling pretty good there. A few texts in the text line from scattered over the week, and you can always send those into 590-590, though I don't know, imagine we'll have a ton of time to get to them today. Brad and Markham asked, should IKF be hitting leadoff? He's been great at getting on base for a while now. I mean, that one is, if he's going to get hit by a pitch three times a game, I would say, yeah, you can bat him leadoff if it's a team that has it out for him, like apparently the Yankees do. Look, there's a reason he's been hitting a little higher in the lineup. His on base is at .332 on the season. That's probably, you know, I mean, that would be a career high. I was going to say that's probably a career high. I just looked at it. It would be a career high right now. So I don't know that on base is going to sustain. And ideally, this team would have, you know, their top hitters hitting toward the top of the lineup. But I have no argument with IKF being bounced around a little bit, because he has been one of the most consistent sticks on this team with a .332 OBP and a .283 batting average. We're going to throw crumple up batting average and throw it out, though, at the request of George Springer and our next guest. It's Russell Carlton of Baseball Prospectus, former MLB team consultant, author of two terrific baseball books, The Shift and The New Ball Game. Russell, man, thank you so much for taking the time out. How are we doing?
I feel amazing.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. Man, and what a quote from George Springer about the shifts in baseball as you've kind of been working on this series. And I don't know if it was intentionally a series of Baseball Prospectus, but this kind of shift from, yeah, we went from average to on base, 10 years ago. Now we're kind of going to, okay, slugging on what you can make contact. Just recontextualizing offensive stats, given in an environment where nobody can hit and nobody can hit for average. George Springer said, by the way, the quote is, don't put batting average up on the scoreboard anymore. It doesn't mean anything. I agree with George Springer, overstating it a little bit. How'd you feel about that quote?
You know, that's I kind of like that quote, and I heard it through the grapevine. I mean, the thing about batting average is that it doesn't describe how teams think about baseball anymore. I mean, we were always taught as kids, get a hit, and that's the biggest thing. You have to get a hit, and now, you know, that means that, you know, a batting average which says, well, you know, how often did you get a hit is a great stat, but now teams are looking at it and saying, what kind of hit did you get? How valuable was the hit? And there are times where you could take an approach where maybe it's a little less likely that you'll get a hit, but it's more like that you'll get high value hit. That's kind of swing real hard in case you hit it, is basically the shorthand for that. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, batting average is starting to take its dive away from relevance. I mean, it uses a set of assumptions that we just don't follow in baseball anymore. And so I didn't mean this to be a series, but it has kind of become the way I've been looking at things lately, and just kind of in my writing. And I've just let the data lead.
Yeah. And look, the numbers, and whether people like this or not, I think the important thing about what you said is, yeah, teams, this is how teams are thinking. It's not, It's not, you know, Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus being like, hey, we don't really like batting average. I love watching Stephen Kwan. I like watching Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Like, I still think hitting is an awesome and fun skill, but there's a reason that league-wide, you know, when Ted Williams last hit 400, the league was hitting 261. Now the league's hitting 240. Like it's much different. I guess the other part of that, though, is that when we do see a Stephen Kwan, Luis Arraez type, it's kind of even more impressive that anyone can hit for contact at that level now.
It's amazing. I mean, it's a skill set, but it's still out there. I mean, you can still find guys who can do that. I mean, they are right there. I mean, they're in front of us. And I mean, Stephen Kwan is fantastic to watch. And I mean, it's fun baseball to watch. And I understand that people, they'll see this, you know, high strikeout type of area of work, and they'll say, I don't like that. And, you know, honestly, I don't like it very much either. But I will tell you that when you're looking for efficient baseball, what's going to score us the most runs, teams have to think about that. And that's why they do that. I mean, that's why they've been signing more guys who are, you know, more kind of the plodding, swing real hard in case you hit it guys. The high contact guys, they're probably still out there. They could probably still be, you know, maybe that's a market inefficiency if the pendulum swings too far back. You can think about things that way. But you know, realistically, you have to be really, really super Stephen Kwan kind of good at that bat to ball skill set in order to make up and get as many singles as you need to kind of match somebody who's, you know, more of a home run threat. And I mean, that is dragging baseball into an area that I don't think people were really ready for. But at the same time, that's kind of where the data are leading. How can I score the most runs? That's what teams are going to be asking themselves.
And even Stephen Kwan is trying to add more power to that profile. He hit a couple off the Blue Jays in two series recently. Mike Petriello of MLB.com wrote about this. So even the super high contact guys are trying to add a little bit of pop there. So that's a part of it, you know, incentive-wise and what wins baseball game-wise. Things have shifted a little bit away to, you know, hey, can you get on base? Can you hit for power? That those kind of things. Another thing is, and you've written about this a couple times, is even if you are the type of guy who puts the ball in play well, if you're a line drive hitter, if you are, you know, a gap hitter even, your results on those plays are way worse now than they were 10, 20, 40 years ago because of the advances in defense and defensive positioning. So, I mean, even if you as a hitter wanted to do those things, you just wouldn't be as capable of doing it probably, right? Unless, again, the Stephen Kwan, Luis Arraez exceptions, but, you know, Tony Gwynn's not walking through that door.
If Tony Gwynn walks through that door, he'll have a job in baseball, but, that's he's kind of a special case. I mean, one of the things that we've seen over, and it started in, I guess, 2012, 2013, so about 10 years ago. And you think about what we were talking about back at the time. We're talking about the infield shift. We were talking about, you know, we've got three infielders over on the right side. What's going on here? And that just kind of came to take over baseball. And that has been, it was a sea change in how teams approach data and defense. But at the same time, they were looking at outfield defense too, which didn't look as weird because it was just, oh, you know, somebody's moving over three steps to the right or three steps to the left. And you weren't seeing it, you know, it didn't kind of violate the norms of, well, there should be two guys over here and two guys over there. But when you look at the number of balls in the air that did not go over the fence, so the defense had a chance to do that, to make some play on them, the number of balls that were being caught, the percentage went way up. And so even putting a ball in the air now is just much more dangerous in terms of making an out than it used to be. And yet teams are still doing more of that. We see that ground balls are down, fly balls are up. Line drives have stayed constant. Line drives are the best thing ever. But, you know, it's just everybody knows that and everybody's kind of making their strategies to prevent them as best they can, as much as they are to try and hit them. And kind of got an equilibrium there. But you'll see teams hitting more fly balls, even though they're easier to catch, mostly because some of them go over the wall, and that's really good. I mean, I think that, you know, in 2024 so far, like slug on fly balls is something in the 600s, and slug on ground balls is something in the 200s. So, I mean, it's a high-risk, high-reward game. But if you math that out, that's the one that seems to make to score you the most runs over time. And that is what they're thinking. And I mean, that, and again, not great baseball to watch sometimes, but that's how it works.
Yeah, so that those are two of the components. So defense has gotten better when you do hit the ball in play. Teams have kind of shifted to incentivizing or prioritizing other parts. And then the other part of this, and this is more about offense in general being down than batting average specifically, is pitchers are just so good. And there's a series up this week at The Athletic. You guys have written about it a lot at Baseball Prospectus, yourself, Robert Orr, a few other people. You know, you used a very nice Fallout Boy adjacent headline for one of your pieces. And you kind of asked the question of pitchers are getting so good. Is there a way for batters to battle back? And in the short term here, the feeling I got from reading your piece was like, probably not. Not in the short term, right?
Not in the short term. I mean, right now you've got... there will probably be some other thing that comes along, but I don't see it on the horizon that will favor the batters. But you think about, I mean, the way that the teams have redefined pitcher usage. You see guys, you know, five and dive used to be an insult. Now it's an average start. And the reason that you do that is that you have four guys who can do innings 6, 7, 8, and 9, and they're all throwing 98 with a wet slider. And, you know, how do you come back against that? And that, you know, knowing pitcher can only says, I only have to throw five innings to start. Well, now he can, instead of pacing himself for 7 or 8, he can just throw everything into those five innings. And so you've got guys who are just kind of going all out, and teams have basically solved that problem just through volume. They've said, we're going to just throw 5, 6 pitchers a game at you, and you're always going to have a fresh arm on the mound. And that change has done so much to, again, ruin baseball, save baseball. You can call it whatever you want, but that's the reality of what we're facing here. So, I mean, I think there is a parallel track where not only pitchers, but I think pitching more generally as an art and as how it's practiced is getting harder. And that's something that we have to deal with. And that right now, if you're a fan of the old 10-9 games that we saw in the 1990s, you're going to be disappointed for a few years, and maybe for a while. So, I mean, those are just the trends that are out there, and I get why they're doing them, and you can like them or hate them.
Yeah, and look, it's still obviously a very good game, a very fun sport. It's just, maybe we'd like some of these 3-2s to be 4-3s a little bit. And I guess, and look, in reading this kind of series of pieces you've done, and knowing the history of baseball a little bit, it's like, yeah, well, the league equilibrium will shift, right? Like they'll change the park dimensions, they'll change the mound, they'll change what hitters are incentivized for, pitchers will adjust, and then hitters will adjust back. And like eventually we'll get back to a bit more of an offensive point, and who knows, maybe it's more average focused, maybe we find a way to bring the doubles back in. But I think my main takeaway from reading your work is we can understand these ebbs and flows and the push-pull between hitter and batter and league stuff. We would just all like to see just like a tiny bit more offense wherever it lands, right?
Yeah, and I mean, in the book, The New Ball Game, which I wrote, I talk about how I think MLB is facing off against some reality here. Is that I think to get some of these outcomes, they're going to have to tinker with the rules, which they've shown a willingness to do. And I mean, we've already seen they wanted to bring down game time. They installed a pitch clock. But they're going to have to tinker with the rules in order to get the thing that they need. So that is – and that – you know, that's going to rub some people the wrong way too. But I think that you're going to have to change some incentives if you're going to get more of the behavior that you want. And that is the task that sits in front of them. And it's, you know, one of the questions I like to ask is, when does it become mutant baseball? When do we stop saying, you know, this is just too weird to be considered baseball. This is something else entirely. And I think that's what what MLB is really coming up against right now. How do we keep the game as recognizable as possible, but still get a little bit more of what we're hoping for in terms of the gameplay? And that's, you know, I think over the next 10 years, there's going to be the action on the field, but there's that meta game that's going to be really interesting to watch.
It'll make for another great book by Russell Carlton to go with The Shift and The New Ball Game. Russell, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Russell Carlton of Baseball Prospectus, former consultant for multiple Major League Baseball teams, and yeah, author of two very good books, The Shift, The Next Evolution in Baseball Thinking, and The New Ballgame, The Not-So-Hidden Forces Shaping Modern Baseball. Really good educational stuff on where baseball is going, how it's gotten here, and where it's going to go in the future. Where it's going to go in the future, the very, very immediate future, like 7.5 hours from now, is Jays Yankees game two of a 4-game set down at Rogers Center. Marcus Stroman, Yusei Kikuchi. This is the game that if you were listening throughout the week, we gave away tickets. So hopefully a few of you listening are going to get to go to that one tonight and enjoy. Of course, the Jays are at home all weekend, Saturday and Sunday against the Yankees. Afternoon game Monday on the Canada Day holiday against the Astros. They've got three more against the Astros at home. Not only a fun one because the weather's going to be better and it's a long weekend in the city and they're good opponents and stuff like that, but pretty damn important games. If you look at the standings, if you hear Ross Atkins talk about it, if you are just paying any modicum of attention at all, this is a pretty big weekend and a pretty big week ahead. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's take a break. Let's get to know this Yankees team a little bit more. Let's tee up Marcus Stroman against Yusei Kikuchi as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little New York for you there. Let's get a little bit more New York into us here as we head into games 2, 3, and 4 of a very pivotal series for the Toronto Blue Jays. Yes, but the New York Yankees have fallen out of first in the American League East, so I'd imagine it's a pretty big one to them. It'll be a pretty big one for Marcus Stroman anytime he pitches back in Toronto. We're joined now by the man covering the Yankees and the Mets for ESPN. It's Jorge Castillo. Jorge, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this. How are we doing? All right, we might not have Jorge after all. We'll give it a second. Jorge, you there, man? How you doing?
Yeah, I am. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I guess first question for you. I mean, I saw the news in the offseason that you'd moved over to ESPN. You're doing the New York Baseball Beat. How's it been? How are you enjoying the season so far?
Yeah, it's been good, man. Yeah, it's covering baseball in New York City. It's a big move from Los Angeles, personally and professionally, but it's been fun.
Yeah, and you've got two pretty fun teams here to cover, including a really fun Subway Series this past week. Where, you get to cover both at once. Obviously, the Mets put it on the Yankees a little bit there, but I'd imagine that's always a pretty fun one, but especially when both teams are playing well.
But I was, obviously the Mets are kind of going the right direction. The Yankees are going the wrong direction, so. That was it was a cool atmosphere. A lot of celebrities came out for those couple games, and it was a good vibe in Queens. And like I said, the Yankees are going the wrong direction. The Mets all of a sudden look like a wagon.
Yeah. So let's focus on the Yankees side of that for now, because they're here in Toronto. Obviously, they are going in the wrong direction. They have dropped 7 of 8. They've fallen out of first in the American League East. They're a little bit behind the Orioles. What do you make of this slide they're on the last week and a half?
Yeah, it starts with the starting pitching. The reason why the Yankees got off to that, great start over the first 2 months of the year was because their starting pitching was really good. Even without Gerrit Cole, Luis Hill was on an all-star trajectory. Carlos Rodon and Nestor Cortez, nice bounce-back seasons. Marcus Stroman was going well. And Clark Schmidt, who's on the injury list, is pitching really well as well. So, over the last week and a half, we saw Gerrit Cole, get roughed up in New York against the Mets. We saw... you guys saw Rodon yesterday in Toronto. It's been like that for 3 starts for him. Luis Hill now 2 starts in a row where he's gotten beaten up. So they're just not getting good starting pitching. The bullpen's been leaky. That's been another sort of weakness this month. And frankly, offensively, they have 2 guys. If this was NBA Jam, the Yankees would be the best team in baseball. But this is not NBA Jam. This is you need 9 guys, and they have 2. So right now they're having issues there. Giancarlo Stanton is on the injured list. Anthony Rizzo's on the injured list. DJ LeMay, he was not hitting. Gleyber Torres he's been so bad that he was benched in each of the last 2 games. This is really just a Juan Soto and Aaron Judge show, and that's just not enough. You combine all that, and the Yankees just aren't struggling. They're getting you know, plastered. They're getting crushed on most nights right now because you add those three things up and it's not pretty.
It's not. And you know, obviously the upside is there. We saw it for the first kind of third of the season there, but you mentioned it. Rizzo's on the IL, and you know that's going to be at least a couple weeks more. Stanton's on the IL. It sounds like that's going to be, you know, at least a month there. And they're having to, you know, this is so patchwork that we're seeing my Jones start games now. They went out and traded old Jays prospect Jordan Groshans for JD Davis. Like they're kind of in triage mode here. It's not the deadline yet. We're a little ways away. But has this kind of like shone a light on the fact that the Yankees are going to, even if things are going well, they should probably add a little bit to the position player side, add a little bit of depth to that lineup behind Soto and Judge?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fact, you know, obviously Rizzo and Stan going down, we're still not sure on a timeline for Stanton, but Rizzo's, you know, he's going to be out for a while. I think it's somewhere like 8 weeks, something like that. So he won't be back for a bit. And he was struggling a lot too before he got hurt. I imagine they're going to add at the deadline, you know, add to the position player group. You know, we saw them sign or traded for JD Davis. They acquired him this past week. He was hitting cleanup in his second game with the Yankees. You know, JD Davis, a guy who, you know, was bouncing around a bit this year, was hitting cleanup. You know, we've seen Gleyber Torres hit cleanup this week, and he was benched 2 days later. This team just doesn't have it, especially against left-handed pitching. That's been their big weakness, you know, hitting left-handed pitching. Because Alex Verdugo against righties is very good. Against lefties is not very good. So when they're up against a lefty, that lineup really, really is top-heavy. And I imagine they're going to go out there. They're going to investigate, you know, how do you make this floor? How do you raise this floor? It's not really, you know, bringing in another star. It's just how do we make this floor you know, a little higher. So I imagine that they're going to try to get maybe a guy to play some second base and third base. John Birdie's on the injured list. That's another guy who can come in and help when he's healthy. But right now the Yankees just don't have enough offensively to really compete to me, at least, for the American League East title and ultimately for the World Series.
So when we look at what that line, and that's obviously you would know best, and that's a pretty good encapsulation there. I think we probably look more on like the infield side when it comes to spots that they could use help, because they have, you know, Soto and Verdugo and Judge and even Trent Grisham in there. But a relevant part of this too is he's not on the major league roster, but Jason Dominguez, at a time when maybe there would have been a role for him, having gotten back from Tommy John surgery, hit the IL in the minor leagues again with an oblique strain that sounds like it's going to cost them a little bit of time. I guess this is kind of a two-part. One being, do you think Jason Dominguez would be on this team had he not been hurt right now? And two, like, does this, I don't know, I don't imagine they would have been super eager to trade him anyway, but the fact that he hasn't been able to stay on the field maybe changes what the value would be there anyway. Do you have a sense of where the org is on Dominguez after another setback here?
Oh, I think he would have definitely been on this roster, you know, when Stan went down, if he were healthy. He was hitting really well before he got hurt. This is a guy who last year in his short time in the big leagues as a 20-year-old really looked the part, really looked comfortable. He can hit. You know, I'm not sure if he – I don't think anyone expects him to stay in center field for too long, but, you know, he can hit the major league level. As for, you know, his trade value, you know, trading him right now, you'd be selling low. That's not the move. This is a guy who's, he's a big leaguer in the future now, you know, whether it's his ceiling is all-star, you know, he's probably going to be an everyday player. You know, he's a guy that you can't sell right now. But yeah, if they add to the position player group, it's going to be in the infield. Outfield wise, they're fine. You know, You got two best outfielders, in my opinion, at least offensively, in Juan Soto and Aaron Judge. What you need to do is figure out that infield. But yeah, having Jason Dominguez get hurt on top of all this, that's tough. That's tough for the Yankees, because he'd be a guy. He's a plug and play guy. If he were healthy, he'd be in that lineup playing every day, batting cleanup, and he'd be really helping this team right now.
Yeah, it would be fun to see as well. It's always cool when a guy that young is on the radar and playing in a big spot like that. So that's the position player side. On the pitching side, I know some element of this is they're just going to have to get better performance out of guys. So Carlos Rodon has had three rough runs in a row after yesterday. Obviously, Stroman, Cortez, Heel have been pretty good. And now they've got Gerrit Cole back. And you mentioned Clark Schmidt on the IL as well. So there are bodies here. when it comes to Rodon having another tough one yesterday, and that's, I think, three tough ones in a row, is there a concern level there for you with the way his season's gone here the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, there's a concern always when a guy gets roughed up three times in a row. Now, you know, once or twice, you know, this happens once in a while, but three times in a row is when it's like, okay, something's up here. We need to figure this out. You know, the Orioles, the Red Sox, you know, the Blue Jays did it to an extent last night, as well as they're jumping on that fastball. You know, Rodon traditionally is a two-pitch guy. He's gone more to curveball, changeup stuff. His other pitches more often this season to be more complete pitcher. But teams are jumping on his fastball, and that's a concern. You know, once you get to, you know, three starts in a row where you're struggling. And last year, you know, he started off the year so well, especially given what happened last year. Last year was such a disaster for him, his first year with the Yankees. It was a nice bounce back. It still can be a nice bounce back, but he needs to rectify what's going on here.
Okay, so let's switch to the positive side, because again, this is a team that until a week and a half ago was, you know, the toast of the American League, and the Jays are still looking up at them like 14, 15 games in the standings. So some things have gone well, including a pretty strong first year as a Yankee for Marcus Stroman, who we know well in Toronto. We're going to see him tonight. Have you liked the Stroman fit there, not just on the field, but it does seem like he's, you know, from afar, from reading your pieces, from reading other people's work, a pretty good fit with the overall Yankees kind of organization as well?
Yeah, he's been a great fit so far. Pretty seamless. Guys in that clubhouse were really, at least they say they really like him. From all appearances, he gets along with everybody in there. So from that standpoint, it's been a really good fit. You know, on the mound, he's been good. You know, it's sort of an under the radar signing. Yes, everybody was sort of waiting to see if the Yankees would sign Yamamoto, and then there was the Blake Snell rumor and all this stuff. But Stroman was sort of under the radar. You know, not too flashy, but he's a guy who over the years, he's pitched well, and he's fit in with the Yankees. He's been a sort of a stabilizer in some ways. And, you know, he's not a guy, as you guys know, he's not going to overpower you. He's not going to, he doesn't have the huge strikeout numbers. He does it in a very old school kind of way. Pitches to contact, ground balls, nibbles on the corners, all that stuff. Sort of a change of pace. And he's done his job well with the Yankees so far.
It's been fun to see. Always a guy that I enjoy watching pitch. Nestor Cortes, who we'll see tomorrow, a real. I know last year was a lot of injury stuff, but to see that ERA kind of boomerang from like, oh, it's down around 250 to, oh, it's up at 5, and now he's back being kind of a 3-ish ERA guy, and just like has decided not to walk anyone ever anymore. Is he kind of, I mean, maybe not all the way back in terms of strikeout numbers and ERA numbers, but is this, you know, are we kind of back with Nestor Cortes and he's back to being Nestor Cortes now? Like the any concern from last year is behind us now?
It seems like last year is behind him. And really, the Nestor Cortes you see, it depends on where he pitches. At Yankee Stadium, he is, I don't know the top numbers off the top of my head, but his numbers at Yankee Stadium this year, the last I checked, were amazing. And then he take him away from Yankee Stadium and he's not that good. It kind of just boils down to that with Cortes. So we'll see how he pitches up there in Toronto. But yeah, it's been, you know, talking about Rodon, sort of a bounce back season. Same thing with Cortes. He's looked more like the guy from 22 when he had that breakout year. And he looked good. And the Yankees, you know, this is a huge question mark going into the season, this rotation. The Cortes, the Rodon, Garrett Cole going on the injured list. You know, Luis Hill stepped up. He's been, you know, he's, as I said earlier, he's struggling a bit now. But, you know, Cortes and Rodon, Cortes has still been, you know, pretty good all season long. Rodon until recently. So those guys, you know, for the most part this year have been good.
All right. So you mentioned Garrett Cole is back now as well. And obviously, you know, no matter what state your rotation is in, getting Garrett Cole back is huge. And the first two starts, whatever. I don't know that anyone's caring too much about the results when he's still, you know, on his way back. Shorter outing in his first one. The Mets kind of get to him in his second one. When we see him on Sunday, what are you looking for as kind of Garrett Cole gets his feet back under him? Hey, it's his third start back now. He's got some reps under him. What's front of mind for you?
Yeah, so command. That night against the Mets a couple of nights ago, that outing, he started off throwing 97 to 90. He touched 99 miles an hour in that first inning. You know, and then that second inning, his first fastball, Mark Vientos hit it out. It was a 91, 92 mile an hour fastball. And obviously the alarms go off when you see Gerrit Cole throw 91, 92 miles an hour. And after the game, he explained it. He said basically he was, you know, that first inning was 28 pitches. He just wasn't commanding his fastball well. He was throwing, you know, it was kind of too hard, too much adrenaline, too much intensity. So he dialed it back a bit. And he dialed it back a bit, maybe too much. And the Mets got to him. He didn't strike out any hitters. That's another number I'm going to look at is he's striking guys out. This is Gerrit Cole. He's a strikeout sort of a machine. He should be putting guys away. He gave up 4 home runs in that start. Again, that had a lot to do with his command. His fastball just wasn't commanding it how he usually does. So I think the big thing is his fastball command. You know, did he sit at 95, 96 instead of going up to that 99 like he did in that first inning and sort of staying steady there? And can he put guys away? Because that's when, you know, Gerrit Cole's at his best is when he's putting guys away. He should be putting guys away. He's, you know, last year, you could argue, was the best pitcher in the world. So, and then the other part of it is just continuing to build up. You know, he's 72 pitches against the Mets. That was a season high. This is basically sort of extended spring training for Gerrit Cole. He didn't really have that ramp up. He had 3 rehab starts. So the Yankees plopped him into this. To this season, he started off against the Orioles and against the Mets, 2 very, very good lineups. And, you know, the results were mixed. But this time around, he should be, you know, a higher pitch count, and he should be sharper.
And, look, this is a team that he's had a lot of success against. The Jays gave him kind of that final assist for the Cy Young last year. 0 earned over 5 2/3, 0 earned over 6, 1 earned over 8, 0 earned over 9 in his final outing of the season. So, yeah, he's had some results here. Jorge Castillo, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Have a terrific weekend.
Thank you, guys.
Jorge Castillo of ESPN, a lot of great coverage of the Yankees and the Mets over there from him. Yeah, Gerrit Cole. I knew that it was a lot, and then I went back and looked at those game logs from last year. Yeah, that is 28 2/3 innings against the Blue Jays last year with a 1 earned run, 24 strikeouts in that as well. So the Jays will have to hope that they're a little better, or that this version of Gerrit Cole is not 1,000% all the way back yet. That's Sunday's start. It'll be Gerrit Cole against Kevin Gausman. Saturday's start is Nestor Cortes against Chris Bassitt. And tonight's start is Marcus Stroman against Yusei Kikuchi. You obviously know Stroman fairly well. I'm sure you remember what Stroman pitches like. It's not all that different now than it was when he was here. And he's actually, you know, faced the players on the Blue Jays roster like a fair amount of times. Now, some of that is you're going way back. Like, he's faced Kevin Kiermaier 40 times. That is not all very recent. Kiermaier is actually 11 for 37 against him, which is like just a ridiculous amount of at-bats to have against one pitcher. George Springer's had iffy results against them. Justin Turner's had iffy results against them. Dalton Varsho's actually homered off of him twice, so maybe that's a bat to watch tonight as well. And then Vlad's 3 for 9, but only singles there against him. So Stroman, very, very good start to his season. You know the deal with him. On the other side, Yusei Kikuchi, been a bit of an up and down season, but mostly very, very strong. His last outing kind of cut short by rain there. It was a bit of trouble when he came out of that one anyway, but we'll see if he can bounce back here. He has also faced the Yankees a ton because this is his third year in a row on the Toronto Blue Jays. Aaron Judge is 4 for 23 against Yusei Kikuchi. Now, he also has 6 walks and a pair of home runs, but 11 strikeouts. So that'll be an interesting to watch. And Juan Soto's 1 for 6 against him. So Jorge mentioned this is the Yankees lineup that struggled against lefties at times. You know, I don't expect Aaron Judge and Juan Soto to struggle against anyone for any amount of time, but interesting that Kikuchi has terrific numbers against them. Gleyber Torres and DJ LeMahieu and Alex Verdugo all have solid numbers against Yusei Kikuchi in a reasonable sample. And then Oswaldo Cabrera took him yard as well. So nothing too crazy there in the matchup stuff other than, yeah, Kikuchi's done a really good job on Soto and Judge. We'll see if that can keep up. Stroman, by the way, has made 3 starts against the Jays since he left, and that's a 1.65 ERA. So pretty good when Stroman's back against his old team. We're done for the day. We'll be back Monday to break those ones down for you. Blair and Barker have you 4 to 6, and then they'll have Jays Talk for you post-game, of course. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, to Ryan Rucco, Alan Roden, Russell Carlton, and Jorge Castillo. Thanks to Amit Mann, Jennifer Rolnick, and Michael Collins. behind the glass as always. To those of you who won the ticket giveaway to go down to tonight's game, hope you have a blast. And to everyone, I hope you have a terrific long weekend. If you're down at the game, awesome. Have a great long weekend either way. We are back Monday. We're not off for the holiday, so we'll be back to break this one down for you on Monday. Have a terrific weekend.